Thank you for standing by. Our speaker today is Glenn Nowak. We would like to remind you, if you would like to ask a question during the call, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star two. Also, due to the high interest of today's conference, if you could please limit yourself to one question. As a reminder, if you're on a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before registering your question. All participants are in a listen-only mode until the Q&A segment. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, and welcome all to today's briefing on the H1N1 outbreak in the United States. I would ask reporters with us, obviously, as you can imagine, there's a lot of media interest in this, and there's a lot of reporters who are calling in, so please do try to limit yourself to one question. At this point, I will turn the press conference over to Dr. Richard Besser, Acting Director of the CDC, for an update. Dr. Besser?
Thanks very much, Glenn. Thanks to all of you for being here this morning. As you know, this is a rapidly evolving situation. It's a situation filled with uncertainty, and our goal is to give you information when we have it, and as we get new information, we will be sharing that with you. As more communities become affected by the H1N1 virus, the activities that public health and the communities are undertaking to try and control this will become more visible. And so there's going to be more concern, there's going to be more questions, and it's very important that people know where to get answers to their questions and where to find the best, most current guidance that we have. We're referring people to our website, and I'll give you more on that in a moment. I've been trying to make the point that there's shared responsibility when it comes to preventing infectious diseases, shared responsibility when it comes to fighting a new infection for which we have incomplete information. There are things that the government needs to do, and we're aggressively doing those things. There's things that communities need to do, businesses need to do, and there's a lot that individuals need to do. I'll go through those again. But let me start with an update on our cases. In the future, we may move away from case updates because as we see more cases and more suspect cases, the numbers become a little murkier, and we'll focus more on where things are occurring and what that tells us about the spread of infection. Today, I'm reporting 109 confirmed cases in the United States. We have 11 affected states with confirmed cases. There are many more states that have suspect cases and will be getting additional results over time. In New York, there are 50 cases, Texas 26, California 14. And again, I'd refer you to the CDC website where you'll be able to find all of this information. The new state is South Carolina, which has 10 confirmed cases, 2 in Massachusetts, 1 in Michigan, 2 in Kansas, 1 in Arizona, 1 in Nevada, 1 in Indiana, and 1 in Ohio. And in the future, I think what I'll do is just give you the overall number and refer you to the website for states. Our median age of cases is 16 years with a range of 22 months to 81 years. The most recent case onset that we are have confirmed is April 26th. The majority of onset dates appear to be after April 18th. Six of the confirmed cases have been hospitalized, including the unfortunate case we reported yesterday of the child in Texas who passed away. I want to put this in context again of the seasonal flu so that people can understand. Influenza is a virus we see every season, every winter. It can cause severe disease. In the United States, on average, there are 36,000 deaths from seasonal flu. So I think as we see this virus in more communities, as we see more people who are infected by this virus, we're going to continue to see a broad spectrum of disease, from milder infections to more severe infections. Unfortunately, I do expect that there will be more deaths. As we continue to look, we will see more cases in more states, and we will see that there are differences in actions across the country. This is a good thing. It's very important that we look to local and state public health to look at their situation on the ground, their local context, and take the recommendations that we're providing and apply them locally. And so you're seeing differences. And we hope to learn from these differences in terms of what are the most effective control strategies for this new infection. There are reports that there's broader school closure in Texas. And we'll look to see what was the impact of that. Is that an effective strategy? You're also going to hear that emergency declarations are made in different states. As you know, we declared a public health emergency in the United States on Sunday. That gives us additional authorities, abilities to do things that we wouldn't otherwise have. That holds true for states as well. And so you'll see states that are affected, many of them declaring an emergency to allow them to respond as effectively and quickly as possible. Let me go through some of the public health actions that are underway. We continue to work with state and local health departments. We continue to work with the World Health Organization and the Pan American Health Organization, and we're working as part of the tri-national team in Mexico. Later this afternoon, we'll be publishing an article in the MMWR. That is summarizing some of the data coming out of Mexico. That's being reviewed still by the various groups that are authors to that. Those bodies include the World Health Organization, the Pan American Health Organization, Canada, Mexico, and the United States. So that will provide additional information on the situation in Canada. As you know, last night the World Health Organization raised the pandemic threat level to 5. This is a good thing. I mean, it doesn't impact on what we're doing here in the United States, but it's really a wake-up call to the rest of the global community that if you haven't been paying attention to what's going on here and in Mexico, it's time to pull out your pandemic plans and think about what you would do if this infection were occurring in your own borders. It's time as a global community as well to think about what are the needs of other countries, what are some of the needs of countries that don't have the resources, haven't been planning as intently as we have been here in the United States. I want to talk about some of the work we're doing in the field. We continue to be deploying the Strategic National Stockpile. This is the collection of antiviral drugs and materials that could be used in hospitals. We have completed deployment to 9 states. Material is moving to the rest of the states. And so all of that should be complete by May 3rd. There are no reports, and we don't expect any reports of shortages of any antivirals in any states. We're doing this movement of drugs as a forward-leaning move in the event this were to become something much bigger than it currently is. We have 34 CDC staff deployed in the field in 5 locations, including 11 staff in Mexico. One thing about the work in Mexico, I wanted to let you know that there is now a lab up and running in Mexico that's able to do diagnosis and confirmation of the H1N1 virus. This is a really big step. It's going to help us with the studies there because we'll really be able to confirm cases and look at the risk factors for those cases, how they were treated. It's going to be very helpful in terms of speeding up the course of those studies. We've expanded greatly our information resources. We've added 50 new staff for our information line, and that's 1-800-CDC-INFO. The other day, with the influx of volume, there was almost a 15-minute wait for some of those calls. We're now down, I think, to less than 90 seconds, which is good, and that's dramatically reduced the drop rate on calls. It's so important that when people want information, when they're concerned, they're able to get it, and that's going to help do that. We're getting 4,000 calls and over 2,000 emails a day. We've added new servers and technology. We're getting 6 to 8 million hits per day on our website. We're doing webcasts. We're doing one later today. We're out there tweeting as well. And I've never tweeted, but for those who tweet, they find that it's a good way to get information. We're issuing more recommendations and guidance. We'll be putting out later today information for colleges and universities on what to do should they have cases on their campuses. We've already put out, we always have had guidance for flu outbreak control, but what this will do is provide some additional guidance for this new strain of what they should do on campuses. Basically, we want people to review their plans and be ready to implement them, track and report illnesses among students, and then promote the same activities we're asking everyone to do in terms of personal prevention. Yesterday we talked a lot about vaccine and the movement towards vaccine, and had discussion around growing up the virus so that we're able to move towards production of a vaccine if we decide that that is warranted, and those efforts still continue to move forward quite successfully. Okay, so in closing, I want to reiterate something that I've said repeatedly. What we call this matters much less than what we do. We continue to be very aggressive in our approach, and we're going to continue to do that until the situation tells us that we no longer need to do so. There's no one action that's going to stop this. There's no silver bullet, but all of the efforts of governments, the efforts of communities, the efforts of individuals, will help to reduce the impact on people's health, and that's very important. The actions will vary by community, and that's a good thing. We'll learn from that what things are more effective and what things are not a good use of resources. And those things that aren't a good use of resources, we want to stop doing them so we can really direct our efforts into things that are showing to work. I know people are concerned, and some people are afraid, and it's important that we do what we can to take those concerns and fears, channel them into personal action and personal planning, because it can be very empowering. There are things people can do, and if people start doing these things in terms of hand washing, covering coughs, staying home when they're sick, it's going to help not only for this, but when future respiratory illnesses come through the community, there'll be a sense of personal responsibility that it really is not a good thing to try to do things that may spread that virus or that infection in the community. Lastly, I just want to let you know how incredibly proud I am of the people here at CDC. This goes for the hundreds of people who are working around the clock on this outbreak control, but also the thousands of people at CDC who are doing our daily public health work. While we are responding to this outbreak, we are also doing the work of promoting and protecting health in other areas. And I just want to acknowledge that here, because they're not here every day. They're doing the work, and it's really an incredible effort here at CDC. And with that, I would like to take your question.
Thank you. Our first question comes from Maggie Fox from Reuters. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks a lot. I would like to ask about the diagnostic test. What tests are available? Can you tell us a little bit about this lab in Mexico, what its capacity is, how long it takes to test someone for H1N1, and where those tests are now, so that we can judge a little bit more about the information that comes in, how long it will take to get a confirmation. Thank you.
Thanks. Testing is an important part of this, and we may change our strategies around testing as this goes forward. When we start to see, or if we start to see more cases in the community, we may look at not doing confirmatory testing with each case. But right now, what happens is you go to your doctor and you have flu-like symptoms, and if the doctor is concerned that you might have the H1N1 virus, they'll take a swab in your nose, and that will be sent to a laboratory for culture. And then from that, there'll be special testing done to see if this is one of the commonly circulating strains of flu. If it's not, it will be sent on to the state lab for confirmation or for testing. At this point, not every state is able to do the testing for the H1N1. Up until, I think, yesterday, CDC was the only place here that you could get that done. We're in the process of rolling out across the country testing capability to every state. The reason we're able to do that is that there's been a major investment over the past 5 years in our state lab capability. And so these labs are ready to go when they get their test kits to ramp up and do additional testing. And so maybe by the end of this conference I can tell you how many states have that so far. I think we can get that information. But our goal is to get it out to all of the states in the very near future.
And can you tell us, does Mexico have a rapid test now?
We have been working as part of the tri-national team, and testing is now available in the laboratory in Mexico to confirm H1N1 disease.
Thank you. Craig Schneider from Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Your line is open.
Right now.
Can you tell me where Georgia stands in terms of having the rapid test and their ability to diagnose and so forth? I understand that Georgia, you know, does not have the best reputation for the communication between doctors and state officials on reporting illnesses.
As a Georgia resident and as a volunteer Georgia physician, I've had great experience with the Georgia Health Department. But we will get information in terms of whether Georgia has that kit now, and if not, when that might be available. Let me take a question here in the room.
Thanks. Mike Stovey from the AC. Dr., Mexican health officials are expressing optimism that they think, seeing signs that they've turned the tide there. What is your assessment of the situation in Mexico? Is it getting better? And also, what's your assessment of what's going on in the United States? Is it getting worse?
So, I think it's premature for me to comment on the situation in Mexico. I'm really looking forward to seeing more data coming out of Mexico to get a handle on that. What we learn from Mexico will be very important for our situation here, in part to try and help us predict what we might see here in the future. As I've been saying over the past few days, trying to understand why they're seeing a different picture in Mexico from here is really the critical question. Whether it has to do with the steps that were taken early on in Mexico, a difference in the virus, a difference in the individuals who are sick, a difference in how long it took them to go for care or the type of treatment given. We don't know the answers to that. I would love to hear and see confirmation that what you say is true. But I don't have information one way or the other on that. Here in the United States, we're seeing ongoing transmission, and that's what we expect to see with a new flu strain. Influenza travels very easily person to person, and so what I expect to see here is ongoing transmission in states. What I expect to see here is a broader spectrum of severity. What I would hope to see here would be, I would love to see that we continue to see the same types of cases we're seeing, which are primarily the less severe cases. But again, hosts vary. People have underlying medical conditions, and flu viruses are not kind to people who have many underlying medical conditions. Another question here in the room.
Hi, Dr. Besser. Betsy McKay from the Wall Street Journal. A couple questions. One is, what is the latest you're discovering about the virus in terms of its virulence compared to other flu strains? I mean, we know it's a novel virus, but I'm wondering if there's anything you can tell yet about the virulence. And I also wanted to ask how much better we are prepared, you know, with pandemic. Could name one or two particular things that have been done over the last 5 years that have been particularly helpful with this. Adding this outbreak.
Great. Thank you. It's premature to say anything about virulence compared to other strains, but that's an important question. The virus is being shared and has been shared broadly, and we look to the research community to be working on addressing those. Dr. Fauci has been talking a lot about the contributions of NIH and the biomedical community and the research laboratories, and they're revved up to be addressing those questions. In terms of preparedness, it's really hard to point to one thing. When you talk about preparedness, you're talking about systems and integrated systems and systems that are practiced. And pandemic flu, if you look at what we have been practicing for the past 5 years and what we've been planning for, pandemic flu was number one on what we were looking at. And while microbes don't read the plan, and you need to move away from the plan pretty soon after day one, the fact that we've been exercising several times a year for a pandemic, and that state and local health departments have been getting tremendous resources for this, it has meant that when it arrived, we didn't have to sit down first and say, let's talk about flu. Here's the things you need to look out for with flu. And with a lot of emerging infections, that's where the conversation's starting. What we find is that we can talk about concepts like community mitigation, which is a term for how do you control something in the community. And the public health community knows what we're talking about. They've been doing planning around that. And that's a big piece. The second piece is laboratory capability, that we have that around the country. And it's a precious resource and one that we need to maintain. Next call from the phone.
Thank you, Maren McKenna from SIDRAP News. Your line is open.
Thanks so much for doing this. I'd like, if possible, to get a little more granularity on the planning for a potential vaccine. You talked yesterday about a seed strain being developed and distributed. Could you let us know if it's been distributed to all the extant flu vaccine manufacturers, and if not, could you let us know which ones are participating? Could you talk at all about how working on a seed strain will impact their production of seasonal flu vaccine for the coming year and whether that's going to work for their timeline? Pretty much any other detail you might have.
Sure. I will tell you what I know on that, and then I think we could share some additional information around vaccine production. We are growing up the virus that would be used for manufacture. So we've isolated the standard strain, and that's being grown up for manufacturers. It hasn't been distributed to manufacturers yet. You grow up the seed stock to a certain level, and then you do pilot testing. You look to make sure that what you have hasn't changed at all, and then that's able to move forward to the production phase. In terms of production, what we are talking about now, and these are still discussions, is that we would complete the production of next year's seasonal flu, so that we have vaccine, so that we would have next year's seasonal flu vaccine, and then manufacturers would switch over to manufacturing a vaccine for this H1N1 disease. That's what we're planning for. We don't need to make that decision right now, because what we need to be doing right now is growing up enough virus and doing the initial pilot test. That's about as far as I can go on that. And tomorrow, Glenn, let's have someone here who could take some more detailed questions on vaccine manufacturing. We wanted to make sure that with vaccine manufacturing, we were still able to protect the country from seasonal flu and be able to protect from this virus if we decided to do so. Here in the room.
Dr. John Lapook, I'm the medical correspondent for the CBS Evening News with Katie Kirk. Have you done any computer epidemiological modeling about how many people you think might be affected in this first strain? And in view of the fact in 1918 that people who were affected by the relatively milder first wave were actually protected when the more serious second wave came, in that modeling, if you've done it, have you thought about whether infection now might actually be protecting people from a potentially deadlier second wave?
We have done a lot of modeling around pandemic preparedness. We have modelers who are involved now, who are giving their advice and input, and I think that modeling can take you so far. It's very helpful to as we consider various potential interventions. So, for example, the issue of border closure. And should you close a border or implement very stringent entry or exit screening? Modeling's been very helpful in showing what's the added value of that. And what it told us going into this was that if you had a pandemic or a potential pandemic strain starting at distant shores, and you implemented very quickly a stringent entry screening, you might be able to delay the widespread dissemination in your country by a few weeks. Now, a few weeks, that doesn't sound like much, but if you don't have it in your borders, that few weeks may allow you to do the kinds of things that we've been doing now, implementing surveillance, distributing countermeasures, doing those kinds of things. Once it's already in your inside, as the president said last night, the horse is out of the barn. And so those measures don't have any added value. And that's helpful information as you're trying to target your resources most appropriately. Your second question about what we know from history about early infections is a really good one and a challenging one. And that's the idea that if you have a mild infection now, it could protect you when this strain comes back at a later time, if it came back at a later time as a more serious strain. And we don't know the answer to that, but it's something that we'll be thinking about and looking at. We'll be looking to see, do those people who have mild infection mount a significant immune response. It's hard to predict that if this goes away, whether it will come back more severe, or like the virus in 1976, would it go away and not come back at all? And so those are some of the discussions that we'll be able to have once we're able to knock this one out, when we're moving on to discussing vaccine policy. Now, I think that as many modelers as you have, you'll have that number of estimates. And it's useful information, but there's no number that we have that we're using. Yes, here?
IATV. Is it safe to fly? I ask that because today on the Today Show, Vice President Joe Biden said if it were his family members, he would tell them not to fly at all, that it's not safe. And what can you tell us about the reported case in West Georgia?
Right. You know, I think this is what we call in public health a teachable moment, in terms of what things are indicated and what things aren't. There's a lot of things that we can do to try and reduce our risk, and a lot of things people are doing on their own. But for us in public health, it's very important to say what things are evidence-based. What things can you do that could put yourself at risk, and what things can you do to reduce your risk? In terms of flight, if you have a fever and flu-like symptoms, you should not be getting on an airplane. That is part of being a responsible part of our community. You don't want to put people at risk. I think flying is safe. Going on the subway is safe. People should go out and live their lives. There are some people who may not be comfortable doing that, but as a public health community, we can put in context what the risk is so that people are doing the things that we know will reduce their risk. The hand washing, the covering of the cough, the avoiding ill people. And if we look to each other to be responsible and not get on airplanes and places when we're sick, that makes everyone else safer. In terms of a case here in Georgia, I refer you for details on that to the Georgia Health Department. They did recently confirm that they have a case of H1N1 disease here in Georgia. But I can't say any more about that case except that they have announced that they have a confirmed case here in Georgia. Rumor on the phone. Take a call for a question from the phone, please.
Thank you. Stephen Smith from the Boston Globe. Your line is open.
Hi. Good afternoon, Dr. Besser, and thanks for taking the question. I'm wondering if you can discuss in the week or so that the agency has really been hip deep into this, what the most important telling scientific discoveries are regarding the virus. In other words, what have you learned further about its transmissibility? What have you learned about it being capable of in any way changing its genetic machinery? What are you seeing about its susceptibility, continued susceptibility to antivirals?
Yeah, I can share a little with that, and then I think tomorrow for our briefing we'll have one of the experts from our laboratory come and give you more details on that. We are sequencing strains of the virus, and what we're looking for is there change as it moves through communities, and we are seeing slight changes, but at this point we're not able to take those changes and say anything about whether it impacts on how severe the infection is. But that's going to be very important. What we want to look at is, as the virus goes from person to person, does it change in any way that impacts on how serious an infection could be? What would you like to see is that it's decreasing as it goes from person to person. We don't have information yet to link the particular strain that someone has to the seriousness of the infection. We only have 109 confirmed infections. We'll be looking at that. We haven't seen any change in our ability to use the current antivirals, oseltamivir and zanamivir, for treatment. We haven't seen any change in resistance, and that's something that we'll continue to look for. But tomorrow, let's have one of the laboratory experts here to provide more on that. Wanted to answer the questions about testing kits. We have preliminary kits in New York and California. These are at the research level to make sure that the kit is operating properly, and then we'll be sending out reagent kits starting tomorrow to all states, assuming that the research kits that went out are working properly. You want to make sure whenever you are developing a new diagnostic test, you want to make sure that it's working and can work as well as what we have here at CDC, and so that's what's going on currently. Here in the room?
PC Connolly from the Washington Post. I'm wondering if there is any value in a situation like this in doing any autopsies, and if anybody has given thought to that, presumably in with the Mexico cases or the one in the United States. Were related, do we know what the actual cause of death has been in most of these, and does that help you in any way by knowing that?
Your first question regarding autopsies, there is a lot that can be learned when you're looking at a new infectious disease in terms of doing autopsies. It can tell you something about how the infection is causing its disease and how it's causing its symptoms. I don't have information to share in terms of cause of death. And I think, you know, behind your question is some of the thoughts that in 1918 with the pandemic, that some of the issue in terms of the high rates of death in the young healthy was that their own immune system revved up and was part of the problem. And so that's a really good question. That's something that people are thinking about and will be looking for. To see whether it's the infection itself, whether it's the immune reaction to that, or whether it's moving on later. In earlier pandemics, there were bacterial infections afterwards that were a problem. So those are things we'll be looking for. We have no information on those right now.
I'm assuming it gets a little trickier with other countries, but it's...
No, it's I'd rather not comment about that particular child or case. From the phone?
Richard Knox from NPR, your line is open.
Yeah, thanks very much, Dr. Besser. I appreciate this. I wonder if we can find out anything about whether there's emerging evidence, as the Dr. Fukuda at the WHO seemed to indicate today, of community transmission being seen in New York, in particular, or elsewhere, beyond schools and families of returning travelers from Mexico. Any evidence of transmission by casual contact in the community? And secondly, I wonder if you mentioned there were 6 hospitalized people now among our confirmed cases. Can you tell us any more about if any of those are critically ill or on ventilators?
I don't have additional information to share on the hospitalized cases. I can refer you to the states for more information, and I think we have, I don't know if we have on our website which states have hospitalized cases. Okay. I don't have additional information to share on that. The studies that are going on in the particular states are looking at the issue of transmission to try and understand that dynamic. We definitely have cases occurring in many states that aren't related to other clusters. And how casual the contact was, I don't think we have information on that, but our experience from influenza virus in particular is that it's a virus that spreads pretty easily person to person. And so it doesn't require, as a virus, that you have to have close personal contact to acquire it. It tends to spread fairly easily. And so we'll be looking to see whether that's the case, but we would expect that it would transmit easier in crowded settings, less so in areas that are less densely occupied, but we don't know yet how easily, and the big question is how easily does it transmit, and are those infections that are transmitted, are they more serious, less serious, and so on, and we don't have information to share on that yet. Two more questions from the phone, and then we'll come back here to the floor.
Thank you. Alice Park from Time Magazine, your line is open.
Yes, I'd like to go back to the vaccine question. Dr. Besser, is it your opinion that were a vaccine to be created from that seed stock that you're working on now, that it would be applicable to cases that are occurring now or as a result of the transmission that's occurring now? Or because it takes so many months to create a vaccine, would this be really looking forward to try to prevent any additional spread of this virus during a flu season, during next flu season?
So our hope is that we're able to see the transmission now go away with the efforts that are underway and with what we know about flu virus transmission, and be ready in the fall to vaccinate people if we decide that is warranted. And so that would be the plan, to work towards developing a vaccine that could be administered in the fall if we felt that a vaccine administration was the way to go. Next question from the phone.
Thank you, Steven Reinberg from HealthDay. Your line is open.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, many outbreaks, there are many more people who are sick but don't seek medical help. Sometimes I think that average is like 30 to 1. Do you have any idea of what that could be in this case?
Are you saying aren't sick?
Well, they are sick, but they don't seek medical attention.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. That's a tough question. When there's an outbreak going on, you can either see people who are sick who aren't seeking medical care, but often we'll see individuals who are sick or are a little sick, and they're concerned because of what they're hearing, and they want to be evaluated to make sure that's not going on. So we don't have information on that phenomenon. We are doing monitoring of ER visits in many places across the country as part of different surveillance systems that are in place. But I don't have data that I can pull off the top of my head about emergency room visits. And last question here from the floor.
Wondering, if we go ahead, if we make the decision to go ahead with the vaccine, what is involved, how much time will it take, and how quickly, you know, can we get something on the market where Americans might be able to get access to it?
Right. But we would be targeting the fall, and then the question is, who gets vaccine? Who do you vaccinate for flu? There we would be looking to see what we learn right now in terms of who are the risk groups that are at greatest risk for having bad outcome from the flu. But then we would also want to engage in public discussion around that and community engagement and input. It's less of a science decision than it is a societal decision, because clearly we would not be looking or able to have vaccine for 300 million people. And let me put that in context as well. We're a resource-rich nation, and when you're seeing a new infectious agent, it doesn't respect borders. And so part of the discussion is around what is our commitment here, what is our commitment as members of the global community. And this is something that will undoubtedly require a lot of discussion and public input to see where we want to go. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for joining today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.